he misrepresented that, just like he misrepresented Judge Gorsuch.
Says the expert in misrepresenting things.
I fall off my chair.
No, I'm not.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove, 92.9 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU in Maui, Hawaii, WGRN 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio, 102.9 FM WLPP in Palenville, New York, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, amongst others, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today for another thrilling action-packed adventure that we call The Bradcast here in these United States. Desi Doyen, how are you holding up today? I know you've got a bit of a cold.
Yeah, I'm getting over it.
Okay, good. I hope so, and I hope you don't give it to me. Thank
me
you very
too.
Much in advance.
Or anybody else.
So you should be doing well today. I should be doing well today, and here is why. You know, I wake up in the morning, one of the first things I do, check my iPhone, the alerts, the news alerts that have come in.
Uh-huh. I thought overnight. You were going to say the first thing you do is panic. But go ahead.
Well, yeah, that A, I panic, and B, I then check my phone, which probably means I'm going to panic even more, and today was absolutely no exception, especially when the headline was France. This was on my alert on my iPhone. France, nuclear power plant explosion.
Yeah,
that kind of thing will set you into a bit of a panic. Of course, it might be the sort of thing that I'm expecting these days every day, but here it was actually on my phone from AP via Time Magazine. French authorities say there has been an explosion in a nuclear power plant's machine room, but there is no leak of radiation. No injuries have been reported. Well, then why use nuclear power plant has exploded as the headline, AP, please?
You know why they do that. They get you to click.
It worked.
Made you look.
The local government for the Manche region in France says the blast at the Flamanville plant on France's northwest coast has been contained and managed. Operator EDF said there were no injuries and that a fire led to a blast in the machine room of one of the two nuclear reactors at the plant. The operator EDF says that the fire was, quote, immediately brought under control and that the number one reactor was disconnected from the grid. So hopefully that's it. Hopefully there is no more to that story. Hopefully we will never discuss it again. And nothing worse happens. And I share it with you by way of saying, hey, see, things could be worse. There's some good news.
See?
A nuclear plant did not explode in France. See, everything's fine. And then, of course, everything may be downhill from there. But including Desi Doyen, you'll be back with a Green News report later in this episode.
Yes, I will.
Which, actually, there is some good news in today's Green News report.
We always try to scour the internet to find the good news.
Yeah, and you found some,
yes.
Actually. But folks will have to stay tuned for that. Shortly after we went off the air yesterday, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions was confirmed as the next U.S. Attorney General. In a nearly party line vote, 52-47, that would be with Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia as the only Democrat who supported Jeff Sessions. Sessions himself is a senator, or was a senator. He voted present, so he didn't vote. All of the Republicans voted with Jeff Sessions. Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, under the law, issued a statement saying, "We're disappointed that the Senate chose to turn a blind eye to Jeff Sessions' long record of hostility to civil rights. We intend to be relentless in holding this Justice Department accountable. The Attorney General has an obligation and duty to protect the civil rights of all Americans. We will not allow the Justice Department to abandon this important work now." A lot of civil rights advocates had similar things to say, as did Dan Pfeiffer, formerly of the Obama administration, who noted Sessions, too racist to be a judge in 1986, when he was rejected in a bipartisan Senate vote, as we discussed yesterday, just racist enough to be in charge of civil rights and voting rights in 2017. Mark Elias of the Democratic Party election and voting rights attorney said this will have profound consequences for voting rights. Before, DOJ fought with us against suppression. Now we will be fighting against the DOJ. We'll be talking about those profound consequences in a bit with my guest coming up. But I wanted to hit a comment here from a Bradblog commenter after yesterday's show posted at bradblog.com. Zap Kitty, one of our favorite commenters.
Oh,
you know Zap.
Yes.
Zap Kitty writes, "Jeff Sessions was confirmed with the help of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a Dem. If Manchin is not successfully primaried, it shall be the certain and inerrant sign of corporate Democratic dominance, even in the face of 2016's total electoral disaster. And so the elites will be allowed to keep on attempting to will their own version of reality into existence until they get us all killed," says Zap Kitty at bradblog.com. Ernie Canning, our legal analyst at bradblog.com, responded to Zap and said, "The Senate GOP's fascist-like silencing of its opposition is intolerable." Ernie was referring to what the Republicans did to Senator Elizabeth Warren when they shut her down for daring to read from a letter about Jeff Sessions and about his attempted voter suppression. Written by Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King's widow. Ernie calls it intolerable. "It is vital that its majority control of the Senate end after the 2018 midterm," says Canning. I also wholeheartedly concur with Zap Kitty that genuine Democrats should target Manchin in the 2018 primary. That should occur in California as well," he notes. Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, correctly opposed Sessions' nomination, but on a host of other issues, she's been a Democrat in name only, says Ernie. So my question for both of them, and I replied at bradblog.com, but this is a question for them there and for you here, if you wish to write in to me at bradcast@bradblog.com. Maybe I'll have some time for your responses on air tomorrow or in an upcoming show. As long as you keep your answers short and sweet, by the way, so it's easier to share. My question to them and to you, while I join the frustration with the very right-wing, very corporatist Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, the idea of primarying him, I have no particular problem with those who wish to do so. But the call for both a 2018 Democratic majority and a more progressive one might be in conflict. A progressive primary challenger, if he or she were successful to Joe Manchin, could arguably result in a far greater likelihood of a Republican being elected to that seat in West Virginia. This is West Virginia that we're talking about here, after all. So while a far more progressive Democratic caucus would certainly be welcome, there's already this uphill fight to gain seats in 2018 for the Democrats. They've got to defend a lot more seats than Republicans do.
Yeah, the race in 2018 is way more difficult for Democrats,
yeah,
this particular go-round.
It is.
It would have been easier last time, but 2018 is really bad for Democrats.
Right. It's really bad, and as is, Democrats need to pick up three seats, I believe it is, in 2018 to get a majority back. They had to pick up three seats. That's in addition to defending all the current seats that will be up for re-election if they want to retake the majority in the U.S. Senate, and if they hope to serve, therefore, as a check, some kind of check and balance to the madness of Donald Trump and the GOP. So while primarying Dianne Feinstein out here in California would most likely, if it was successful, it would most likely result in a more progressive Democratic senator here in California, whether it's, you know, the successful challenger or whether it's Feinstein herself who has moved to the left because of such a primary. The West Virginia seat, it would arguably result in a more progressive caucus, surely, but one that could still be in the minority and unable to block Trump. This would make it harder, potentially harder, for Democrats to take back the majority. Okay, fine. So what's more important here? A Democratic majority in the Senate as a check and balance on Trump's madness, or a more progressive one, including what could be a smaller one, because a Republican could take that seat? The Democrats would have a more progressive caucus, but it might be a smaller one and not in the majority. So what's more important, a Democratic majority or a more progressive one that is more likely to still be in the minority? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I'd love to hear your answers. If you have any thoughts, drop me some email. Bradcast@bradblog.com, because I suspect this is going to be a question that's going to come up a lot between now and 2018. So anyway, I'd love your thoughts. Speaking of a more progressive, more courageous Democratic caucus, here's today's distraction, at least one of them anyway, from the White House. Over the weekend, you'll recall Donald Trump attacked a federal judge, a George W. Bush appointee in Washington State, as a, quote, so-called judge for halting his executive order that banned travel from 7 Muslim-majority countries, as well as indefinitely halting Syrian war refugees from coming into the country. Well, on Wednesday this week, Senator Richard Blumenthal said that Neil Gorsuch, Donald Trump's nominee for the stolen U.S. Supreme Court seat. Blumenthal said that he met with Gorsuch and described Donald Trump's tweets attacking that federal judge as, quote, disheartening and demoralizing. That during their private meeting, and urged the Supreme Court nominee, Blumenthal did, to make those comments public. A spokesman for Gorsuch, within 30 minutes after the meeting, confirmed Gorsuch's comments to CNN. But on Thursday morning, today, Trump contradicted the spokesman in a tweet, saying that Blumenthal was, quote, misrepresenting Gorsuch's comments. And also, Trump went on to say as much on camera today.
His comments were misrepresented. And what you should do is ask Senator Blumenthal about his Vietnam record that didn't exist after years of saying it did. So ask Senator Blumenthal about his Vietnam record. He misrepresented that just like he misrepresented Judge Gorsuch.
Yeah, he didn't misrepresent Judge Gorsuch. I can talk about his military thing in a moment, although that is part of the bait that I hope people do not take. Both of Judge Gorsuch's official representatives, Ron Bongean and former GOP Senator Kelly Ayotte, both working with Gorsuch on his nomination, serving as his spokespeople. Both of them have publicly confirmed that Gorsuch said these things and that Blumenthal's comments were, in fact, accurate. In fact, in a statement out this morning, I believe that was before Trump came out and made these claims on camera in any event, that he didn't say these things. But Ayotte's own spokesman, Gorsuch's own spokesman, Ayotte, said in a statement out this morning that Gorsuch finds any criticism of a judge's integrity and independence, quote, disheartening and demoralizing. Moreover, several other senators, including Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, later relayed almost identical accounts of Gorsuch criticizing Trump's public attacks on the judiciary branch. So this is just a fact. No matter how much Donald Trump says it was misleading, a misleading characterization of Gorsuch. And on that military comment, yes, Blumenthal enlisted in the Marine Reserves after multiple deferments during Vietnam. Trump, on the other hand, who was also eligible for the draft during the Vietnam War, Trump never enlisted for nothing. He obtained multiple student deferments. Ultimately, he got a medical deferment for a supposed bone spur to avoid the military draft entirely. So Blumenthal, Senator Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, has said he served, quote, in Vietnam, though he didn't. He served during Vietnam. But when he ran for Senate, he was somewhat opportunistically accused of purposely trying to mislead about his service. He has apologized for that. But that's why one of the reasons Donald Trump put that bait out there. Don't take it. CNN deserves credit today. Good for CNN for their headline. Trump falsely accuses senator of misrepresenting Gorsuch's criticism. But here's the thing. All of this is a distraction. All of it. Don't fall for it, Democrats. This is meant to make it look like Gorsuch is independent from Trump. The more that you Democrats and the media focus on this squabble, as if it's a squabble between Trump and Gorsuch, the more it's going to feel like you are defending him and an independent judiciary from Donald Trump. And I know it's your knee-jerk reaction, Democrats, to, join forces with whomever Trump appears to be in opposition to. But don't fall for this one. Don't get in there defending Gorsuch, become his friends, because here are the only facts you need to remember, Democrats in the Senate. If you give a damn about an independent judiciary, you will remember nothing else other than the fact that this is a stolen Supreme Court seat and a stolen Supreme Court majority if Gorsuch is allowed to be seated on it. It was stolen in an unprecedented GOP coup. After they refused to even hold hearings for the past year, more than a year since Antonin Scalia died, on presidents, they wouldn't hold hearings on President Obama's very centrist, two centrist nominee, Merrick Garland. So don't fall for the bait by taking Gorsuch's side against Trump. I know it may feel good to, prove Trump wrong. It may feel good, but it is a mirage. You have a duty, Democrats, to protect the court by filibustering anybody but the rightful nominee to the seat, which frankly is Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, period. And if you don't, you go from protectors of democracy to enablers and collaborators of fascism, of tyranny. Filibuster, Democrats, period. Even if it leads to Republicans doing away with the filibuster and seating whoever they want anyway. That's probably what's going to happen in the U.S. Senate. But the Republicans are going to do that anyway. And the only ones who respect that filibuster, frankly, are Democrats when they're in the majority. They only respect it when the Republicans can use it to block Democratic nominees. So the other thing to remember, Democrats, don't fall for this. Don't fall for this fight. Don't get into it. Don't be backing Neil Gorsuch as if he's some hero for standing up to Donald Trump. But the American people have your back on this. I think we talked about it yesterday on the show. New CNN poll says by 51-41%, Senate Democrats are justified, according to the American people as a whole, Republicans, Democrats alike, American people would be justified in using the filibuster to stop Gorsuch, or at least try to stop him. So 51-41%, and the Democrats haven't even started on this. So the wind is at your back, Democrats. Don't fall. Don't fall. And you can call your Democratic or Republican senators and give them your opinion. 202-224-3121 is the U.S. Capitol switchboard. Call them and let them know your opinion on filibustering Gorsuch. And that they should not get distracted by this nonsense. Neil Gorsuch is not their friend, no matter how much he might appear to be opposing their enemy, Donald Trump. All right. I know we got to get to a quick break, but let me hit this very quickly. Jeff Sessions, as I said, he was confirmed as the new attorney general, and he immediately started lying about stuff today. He said today that he thinks a rise in crime is a, quote, dangerous permanent trend in the United States. Of course, that contradicts actual facts and actual data from people, if you trust them, those liars over at the FBI. Sessions said, we have a crime problem. I wish this were some sort of aberration or blip, but it is a dangerous permanent trend. No, it is not. The number of violent crimes in the U.S. Rose in 2015 compared to the year before, but according to the FBI's data released in 2016, the total was still lower than levels back in 2011, 2006. It's been a long-term trend down. Crime is falling. The crime and murder rates have been on a long downward trend, and they are now at lows not seen since the 1960s, no matter what Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump say. This is checkable. But facts no longer matter to this administration, and while it's hilarious and distracting, you know, when someone like Kellyanne Conway pretends there was a non-existent massacre by terrorists somewhere in Kentucky, Bowling Green strong. It's damn dangerous when the nation's top cop is preparing to enforce the law based on made up alternate facts and alternate statistics falsely presented to justify an ideological and political agenda. That's dangerous. And that conversation and how, if possible, the American people can prepare for it and what is likely coming is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. AP is reporting that four North Carolina voters are suing a Republican political activist they say falsely claimed that they voted illegally last November because they were felons or voted in other states. The libel lawsuit was filed on Wednesday of this week in Greensboro, by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, according to AP. The suit said that William Clark Porter's false characterization led the four plaintiffs to face, quote, ridicule, contempt, or disgrace. Porter did not respond to telephone or email messages from AP seeking comment, but he had filed three of numerous post-election challenges by Republicans and allies contesting the results in 52 of the state's 100 counties in North Carolina as then-Governor Pat McCrory fought to overcome an Election Day deficit. Nearly all of the protests filed, all of these claims by McCrory and his supporters, nearly all of them were dismissed or sidelined by elections boards in the state on which Republicans held the majority. Pat McCrory, the governor, conceded to Democratic candidate Roy Cooper, who is now the governor. It was a very, very close race. But of course, when it ended, Pat McCrory claimed that there was voter fraud all over the state. There was not. And they began to name these people who had committed this fraud when they had not. So now at least four of them are fighting back. Good for those plaintiffs. That's one way to push back at this fraud BS that Republicans haul out before every election and after the ones that are really, really close and they want to pretend that they were stolen by Democrats. So I say, great, sue the bastards. Of course, that's just one of the reasons why Jeff Sessions and his new appointment as U.S. Attorney General is so dangerous and ominous. As we discussed in detail on yesterday's program, he had brought false charges against black civil rights activists and heroes back in 1985 when he was the U.S. United States Attorney in Alabama. in an attempt basically to chill, and it was a successful attempt at the time, to chill African-American participation in elections in Alabama's Black Belt. A year or two ago, I mean, over this past weekend, Donald Trump picked up with his false claim. It feels like a year or two ago. Donald Trump picked up with his false claim that 3 to 5 million illegal votes were cast in the 2016 election during his Super Bowl Sunday interview with a very friendly Bill O'Reilly of Fox News.
Is there any validity to the criticism of you that you say things you can't back up factually? And as the president, if you say, for example, that there are 3 million illegal aliens who voted, and then you don't have the data to back it up, some people are going to say that's irresponsible for a president to say that. Is there any validity
to
that?
Well, many people have come out and said, I'm right. You know that.
I know, but you've got to have data.
Let me just tell you. And it doesn't have to do with the vote, although that's the end result. It has to do with the registration. And when you look at the registration and you see dead people that have voted, when you see people that are registered in two states that voted in two states, when you see other things, when you see illegals, people that are not citizens and they're on the registration rolls. Look, Bill, we can be babies, but you take a look at the registration. You have illegals, you have dead people, you have this. It's really a bad situation. It's really bad. And
so you think you're going to be proven correct in that statement?
Well, I think I already have. A lot of people have come out and said that I am correct.
Yeah, but the data has to show that 3 million illegals voted.
Forget that. Forget all of that. Just take a look at the registration, and we're going to do it. And I'm going to set up a commission to be headed by Vice President Mike Pence, and we're going to look at it very, very carefully.
Well, that's good. Let's get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Forget that. Forget that 3 million that I repeated over and over again. Of course, he would like people to repeat that because it was completely and utterly false. As is his claim that many people have said, I'm right. You know that, right? And, of course, O'Reilly compliantly said, oh, yeah, sure. But you need the data. Well, there is no data. You'll also notice that Trump carefully modified his claim about people being registered in more than one state. He used to say there are people who are registered in more than one state. Now he says registered in more than one state and voting in more than one state. He had to modify that because, as it turns out, his son-in-law and his top White House advisor, Jared Kushner, is registered in more than one state. His White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, was registered in two different states, along with Trump's daughter, Tiffany, his top political strategist, Steve Bannon, his Treasury Secretary nominee, Steve Mnuchin, all also registered to vote in several different states. Now, Trump says, registered in two states, but he added, voted in more than one state. Because so many people are registered in more than one state, because they move and they don't bother calling their old state's county clerk after they move to ask them to remove them from the voting rolls in the old state, or because they die, and in which case they really forget to call the county clerk and tell them to remove them from the rolls. So what's going on here? Well, we've spent quite a bit of time since the election and in the many years before the election telling you exactly what's going on here. We've discussed Donald Trump's call for this major investigation, as he calls it, into what he describes as, quote, voter fraud. His bogus claims have been repeatedly debunked on this show and elsewhere, specifically his claims that he would have won the popular vote, which he lost, by the way, by nearly 3 million votes. He would have won it if not for some 3 to 5 million illegal votes cast for Hillary Clinton. But he doesn't want you to think about that anymore. Again, there is zero evidence to support that claim whatsoever. And even the authors of the studies that were cited by the White House to support Trump's bogus claims, those authors have all disputed that their reports even come close to backing up Trump's assertions. So who are these lots of people who said I'm right, as Trump claims? Well, they are largely one guy who works with a right-wing group named True the Vote, who have been lying for years and years about voter fraud in hopes of instituting photo ID voting restrictions to keep millions of perfectly legal, democratic-leaning voters from being able to cast a vote. as Jeff Sessions was confirmed in the U.S. Senate yesterday. True the Vote tweeted their congratulations to Jeff Sessions, said they looked forward to working with both him and the DOJ. Well, of course they do, because this is about imposing restrictions on the right to vote and even the right to register to vote, all using false claims about registration and non-citizens and so forth. And by the way, as if all of this stuff about Trump's family and his staff who are registered to vote in multiple states, as if that was not enough to embarrass him, there's this from AP. Just late last week, a man who President Donald Trump has promoted as an authority on voter fraud was registered to vote in multiple states during the 2016 presidential election, the AP has learned. Greg Phillips, whose unsubstantiated claim that the election was marred by 3 million illegal votes was tweeted by the president. He was listed on the rolls in Alabama, in Texas, and Mississippi, according to voting records and election officials in those states. Apparently, he voted only in Alabama in November, according to records. But in a post earlier this month, Philip described, quote, an amazing effort by volunteers tied to True the Vote, an organization whose board he sits on, who he said found, quote, thousands of duplicate records and registrations of dead people. Apparently, the claim of 3 million illegal votes comes from Greg Phillips. Shortly after he appeared on CNN to repeat those claims again, Trump tweeted, look forward to seeing the final results of Vote Stand. That's Phillips' specific group. Greg Phillips and crew say at least 3 million votes were illegal. We must do better. That's what Trump tweeted, but of course he wants you to forget about that claim now, and he certainly wants you to forget about the fact that Greg Phillips was registered in several states. Writing recently in response to Trump's entirely inaccurate assertions, Michael Slater, president of ProjectVote.org, said, debunking Trump's voter fraud lies is not enough. We must also prepare for what comes next. First come the lies, then come the laws, Slater writes. That has been the pattern of the Republican Party's voter suppression strategy since the Bush administration. Now, the ridiculous and unsubstantiated claims Trump and his administration are making about illegal voting would seem to forewarn of an unprecedented top-down attack on voting rights led by the White House. Well, what does come next, and how can we be preparing for it in the meantime? After all, the only way ultimately that we can correct this insanely off-course ship now is to vote these guys out of power at the next possible opportunity. That's how democracy is supposed to work. But when you've got gerrymandering and corporate money and politics on top of voter suppression, that became worse than it has ever been since the Jim Crow era following the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act. And now these new efforts underway to restrict the vote, undoubtedly to be led by Jeff Sessions as the U.S. Attorney General. How can democracy, as we have come to know it, as precarious, frankly, as it has already been allowed to get in this country, how can democracy possibly survive? How can we get prepared now rather than waiting until, you know, weeks or months before an election when it's largely too late to make any real changes to our system? Joining us to discuss how to prepare for what comes next in that regard is Michael Slater. He's the president and executive director of ProjectVote.org, which works to ensure all Americans can register, vote, and cast ballots that count. Michael came to Project Vote back in 2004 with more than a decade's experience in community, labor, and faith-based organizing. At Project Vote, he led successful efforts to overturn restrictive voter registration laws in seven states under Project Vote's Election Administration Program. And he became the executive director of Project Vote in 2008, helping in the run-up to that election to organize one of the most successful voter registration efforts in the nation's history. Michael has contributed to the passage of positive election legislation in several states, has authored or edited numerous articles and publications on election policy, and is frequently called upon to testify in places like Congress on election issues. Michael Slater, sir, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
Well, good to have you here. Let's just jump into your piece here. You write that the myth of widespread voter fraud has been debunked so many times, we can scarcely believe we are still having to counter it. I share your disbelief, Michael. That said, I think it's necessary, frankly, that we keep repeating these facts until we're sick of repeating them, and then we need to repeat them again. I think I'm paraphrasing Frank Luntz on that point. That's what Republicans do. It's an effective strategy, in their case, to disinform the American people. So why are Democrats and progressives, as you see it, less successful in getting out the facts of voter fraud and voter suppression? And feel free, by the way, as sick of it as you may be, to do a bit of debunking just to help set the table here.
Well, I don't know if I would say that we are less successful. When I look at the coverage of news stories and when I look at liberal and progressive voters, people who are even remotely informed, they are much more comfortable saying that there's very little voter fraud in America and it doesn't affect elections. I think that's very different from when we were looking at this issue way back in 2006 during the Bush years and the Attorneygate scandals. So I think we actually have moved the needle quite a bit. The challenge for us, just like it is for the rest of politics in America, is we have 30% of the population, the voting population, that is getting their news from Fox News and other unreliable sources, mm-hmm. and they're really not open to looking at the facts, and they're not open to weighing their conclusions against current evidence. So I don't know if we're ever going to get to those folks until they change their minds about how they want to look at and understand the world. I think in terms of whether or not a moderately informed voter, a policymaker, a member of the media, think to whether or not they understand and can debunk the voter fraud claims, I think we've succeeded at that. And I think that's why Trump is really on the ropes on these claims.
I'm glad to hear you succeeded with that, or that the media, or that we have succeeded in informing the media. I'm not quite so sure. I still see, and I'm concerned, you know, I still see reports that, Democrats say that photo ID restrictions are meant to suppress the vote. However, proponents of photo ID says it's needed to stop voter fraud. You know, despite the lack of evidence that, yeah, you know, there is voter fraud, but just almost zero voter fraud carried out by people at the polls, you know, using false pretenses.
Right. I think you're right that the media is still having trouble with this, with these issues of false equivalency. We know that voter ID suppresses the vote. We know that there are almost no instances of in-person. Matter of fact, I don't think I know of any instances of in-person voter fraud. Certainly nothing coordinated that has ever impacted an election.
Mm-hmm.
But the media feels obligated to do the he said, she said, and report on those statements. The problem is they don't take the next step, or not everyone takes the next step.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've seen some improvement in this, in evaluating those two statements. And certainly when we see the Trump administration come out and make these completely unsupported, grandiose claims, I see an eagerness in debunking that I never saw in 2006, where an election official would come out, make these big statements about voter fraud, and just be taken at face value.
Yeah.
And then months and months later, you'd get a statement saying, oh, well, nothing came of that. So for me, I'm kind of positive. I feel positive about that.
All right, I'll take it. And I think you're right. I mean, I have seen more a better and more aggressive response to Trump's latest nonsense about millions of illegal votes than I ever recall seeing in our corporate media. So we'll take some comfort there for the moment. Looking for comfort.
I mean, I think you led some of that back in 2006, right? I mean, you were a voice in the wilderness then, and today, I think that's come a long way.
I've been trying to lead it for a decade or so, and you're right. And so we should take something from that victory, but you suggest that that this latest lie from Trump foretells a massive push from the executive branch that will make it meant that is meant to make it harder for American citizens to vote. As someone who has yourself, you've been there all along, been a part of that voting rights community now for many years. What makes you so certain that that's where we are headed with this new effort? Is it a fear, or do you really have evidence that this is how they're going to move forward to make it harder for all Americans on a national level, not just a state-by-state level, as they've been doing?
Well, I think if I am afraid. I am afraid that we are going to see an all-out push by the executive branch to restrict voting rights and to make laws harder for people to vote. I think that effort is going to embolden the states even more than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
The basis for my fear comes from the fact that this is the GOP playbook. You make allegations of voter fraud, even when they're not supported, and then you follow up with proposals for restrictive laws. We have seen this play out in many, many cycles now, mm-hmm. really since 2000. So I think just the fact that they're taking the first step in their playbook and they're doing it so aggressively from an individual who has presented himself as very aggressive and unmoored with facts is enough to be alarming. The fact that he has nominated Jeff Sessions to serve as Attorney General, who has a history of fraudulently pursuing activists over voter fraud. He has taken meetings and is likely lining up an appointment for Kris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who has made a career out of falsely alleging that voter fraud is a threat to our elections. I think because of these facts, I am very, very nervous.
Yeah, I share that. And I think one of the points I think in my initial question there when I was referring to Democrats and progressives, you know, Republicans never let this go. They keep repeating this stuff over and over and over again. And you don't see a similar effort by Democrats or even by progressives in general. You know, there are small groups. The work that Project Vote has done over the past decade has been absolutely heroic, frankly. But you're a small group, and there are a lot of, small groups. I don't see that sort of drumbeat from Democrats to expand voting rights and to repeat it over and over again the way I see people on the right repeating these false narratives over and over again. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what seems to be missing.
I would agree with you there. I think that the Democrats have never been as supportive of voting rights and put as much energy into expanding voting rights as we have seen the Republicans in their efforts to restrict voting rights. I think that is a shortcoming on the part of the Democrats, and I think it is in part because the Democrats have their own shortcomings in terms of how progressive they are and how interested they are and expanding the electorate in America. They're not certainly a progressive or really very left entity. They're a pretty moderate entity. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of bringing new people into the electorate or people who are not regular voters creates some uncertainty for them, and they're not comfortable with that.
Mm. Yeah, and that's disturbing in and of itself. All right, you talk about being ready for what's coming. Let's talk about some specifics. Do you see this as a precursor to a nationwide photo ID voting restriction? Studies have shown that could result in some 20 to 30 million Americans from being able to cast their otherwise legal vote, Americans that don't have the type of ID that has been at least required in the states that have passed these type of voting restrictions. Is that one of the things that you expect to come out of this?
I think it is very reasonable to expect a national photo ID bill coming out of this Congress. I am much, much more worried, however, about a national proof of citizenship bill, specifically perhaps an amendment to the National Voter Registration Act that will require DMVs, public assistance agencies, and anyone taking a voter registration application to have the applicant provide documentary proof of citizenship. I think that is the biggest single threat that we're facing right now.
And thanks for highlighting this, because we hear a lot about, the Voting Rights Act, particularly now that its central provision has been killed for now by the Supreme Court, but not as much about the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. You've done a lot of work on the NVRA. So explain very quickly what that law is and why, and if you feel, is it on the chopping block, or are they just going to expand it to make it defeat its general purpose?
First, the National Voter Registration Act, you're right, is certainly less well-known than the Voting Rights Act, but it is very critical. It is what has made voter registration so accessible mm-hmm. across the country. It requires Department of Motor Vehicles to offer everyone a chance to register to vote when they apply or renew their driver's license. It requires public assistance agencies like those that administer Medicaid or what you see the food stamps program to offer voter registration to people when they interact with government. It also protects people from voter purges. States may not purge voters within the last 90 days before an election. They may not purge voters just because they haven't voted.
Mm-hmm.
If they believe someone has moved but they're not sure, they have to send them notice
mm-hmm.
and wait two federal election cycles. It is a critical piece of our voting rights infrastructure in America. And there are Republicans who very much do not like it, including Steve King in Iowa, who blames the Motor Voter Act, the National Voter Registration Act, for undocumented people voting. We know that the Secretary of State in Kansas, Chris Kobach again, is a vehement opponent of the National Voter Registration Act because it is so successful. My belief is that it's likely that there will be an amendment to require proof of citizenship again, or they will try and get rid of some of the purge protections.
And one of the things about proof of citizenship, it sounds reasonable, but what it means is that it will radically, because people don't, they don't have this proof of citizenship handy, it would then, radically restrict voting rights groups from going out there and, signing up people on the street. Most people don't walk around with their passport in their pocket when they're asked to register at a fair or something like this.
Correct.
So that's a very serious concern. But all right, Michael Slater, you write, we must be prepared to fight back against all of this. I agree. I bite. But how do we do it? How do we stop this train? What do you and Project Vote see as the top priorities to fight back against what is likely coming? Too many people, I think, wait until they're run over by the train before they fight back. So I appreciate your call to say we must prepare. But what does that mean? How do we prepare?
Well, I think it first means that we need to educate members of the House and Senate, both Republicans and Democrats, about the devastating impact this is going to have in their states. Chris Kobach found that there were just thousands of ordinary Kansas residents who could not vote in their election because they did not have a current, an acceptable birth certificate available to them
mm-hmm.
or a passport. It was just a huge disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Over 15 million people register every 2 years through one of the NVRA mechanisms, and that will come to a crashing halt in America if a proof of citizenship requirement is put into place. So it's very important that Congress understand that. I think it's very important that Senate Democrats understand what the motivation is behind this and what the implications are behind it. We still have the filibuster in America, and I think it's incredibly important that our Senate Democrats understand that when it comes to voting rights, we can't allow them to make compromises or engage in any sort of horse trading. We cannot allow voting rights to go backwards in America. And I think we need to make sure that moderate Republicans, to the extent that those still exist, understand that this is really an effort at trying to limit the ability of people of color, particularly, from participating in the election. There are some Republicans that really don't believe that's the right way to win elections, and I think we need to be talking to them.
So this is a matter of pressuring Congress, pressuring your Congress member, your senator. I fear that people don't do that until it's too late, and until the law to restrict voting has been put out there. I wish there was something proactive way that we could recommend, to people to take action here. Because I think if you wait, it's too late, Michael.
I guess we're talking about it today and it hasn't been introduced. So I think we're trying to get that message out right now. I don't know, how to prevent Congress from putting in a bill before it gets done,
mm-hmm.
Other than to make people aware of it. I think we've been very, very impressed. Everyone has been very impressed with the willingness of people to get out on the streets when there are challenges to our fundamental beliefs as a country. I think that's very reassuring for us. You know, there's always litigation, but that happens well after a bill has passed. So I think, you know, I don't think we want to put too much stock in that. I think we really do have to look to Congress to hold the line on some of these issues, and not only in voting rights, but in a wide variety of areas that are important in America.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about, looking to Congress to hold that line. I think that we the people need to do it. Michael Slater, before I let you go here, how can we help projectvote.org, which, again, you guys do absolutely crucial work all year round, but, you know, certainly in the lead up to elections, but all year round, and not just when there's a Republican, you know, in the White House. How can we help you guys do your work at projectvote.org?
Every nonprofit appreciates donors, so people are welcome to go ahead and make a contribution to Project Vote. But if you don't want to do that, please sign up for our newsletter or follow us on Twitter. That's always very helpful.
On the Twitters, they are Project Vote. You can also find Michael when he's not busy testifying to Congress on C-SPAN. You can also find him on the Twitters at MK Slater. On Twitter, and of course, follow everything they do over there at projectvote.org. Michael, great to talk to you again. I suspect we'll be doing it again in the future.
I have that same feeling. Thank you, Brad.
You bet. All right, a quick break, and we're back with the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. Oh, some breaking news. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the broadcast. Some breaking news, as I said before the break, and some good news. A 3-judge federal appeals panel on Thursday unanimously refused to reinstate Trump's targeted travel ban, according to the New York Times, delivering the latest and most stinging judicial rebuke to his effort to make good on a campaign promise and tighten the standards, et cetera, et cetera. So this was the decision from the Ninth Circuit Court. It obviously just came in. I haven't been able to look at it yet at all. But this is a huge blow to Donald Trump, particularly since the 3 judges on here, one of them seemed quite sympathetic in many regards to Donald Trump, was a Reagan appointee. This was a unanimous decision against Donald Trump, who now tweets in all caps, "See you in court." Good luck with that, Mr. President. All right, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
And we're going to keep pushing forward. We're going to keep fighting this thing. It's not over until it's over.
Standing Rock Sioux Tribe vows to keep fighting against Dakota Access Pipeline.
It doesn't help the United States if it leaks, right? It doesn't help the people who live downstream.
I'm not going to win that argument with you because pipelines do leak.
New study finds owners of the pipeline reported 69 spills in the last 2 years. Air pollution linked to increased risk of dementia. More Americans now work in solar jobs than coal jobs. Plus, Sweden votes to go zero emissions by 2050.
Hope that's soon enough. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
So it's not safe. It's just safe enough for the Native Americans. No, it's not a race thing. It's that if the pipe leaks, there's fewer of them than of us. And why are there fewer of them?
Yep. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, things are not looking good up in North Dakota.
Nope, there is bad news for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, under the direction of the Trump administration, this week suddenly reversed course and granted the final easement needed for completion of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline, allowing it to cross under the Missouri River near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation in North Dakota, an easement that the Corps had previously denied under the Obama administration. The reversal halts a pending pending environmental impact assessment and further consultation with the tribe, which has fought the pipeline for years with massive protests and in the courts because it threatens their sacred sites and their water supply. Remember, the pipeline had originally been routed away from the majority white city of Bismarck for that exact reason. In an interview with Democracy Now!, Tribal Chairman David Archambault vowed to challenge the decision in court.
Our treaty rights are violated. Our human rights are violated. The federal laws are being violated. But we need to get that out there. We need to be heard by decision makers. And it seems like the process is trying to expedite and facilitate something that's unlawful.
The tribe has vowed to challenge the decision in court on the grounds that the environmental impact statement was wrongfully terminated. The pipeline company says construction will start immediately.
Of course it will, because to hell with the rule of law, to hell with those Native Americans. They don't deserve clean water and sacred grounds.
Protests in solidarity are again erupting against the pipeline around the country, including at local offices of banks that are invested in the pipeline. In the wake of the Army Corps decision this week, the City Council of Seattle voted unanimously to divest more than $3 billion held with Wells Fargo, becoming the first major city in the country to sever ties with a bank because of its investment in the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Go get 'em, Seattle.
And they were followed shortly thereafter by Davis, California.
Nice going, Davis.
And inspired by the Women's March, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and tribes across the country are now teaming up and inviting allies across the country to join them at the Native Nations March that's on March 10th in Washington, D.C., and held with satellite marches around the world.
A lot of marching lately. Going to be a boon for the shoe industry.
And now a new study released this week backs up the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's concerns over the pipeline. An analysis of federal and state records done by the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, a state-based environmental justice group, found that the company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, has reported 69 spills over just the last 2 years and polluted rivers in 4 states. Again, that's 69 pipeline spills in just 2 years.
What could possibly go wrong?
Meanwhile, another impact of fossil fuels, Alzheimer's disease. A new study links long-term exposure to vehicle exhaust and other sources of fine particle air pollution and finds that long-term exposure nearly doubles the risk of developing dementia, particularly in older women.
Anybody check the air quality outside of Trump Tower lately?
That's on top of the healthcare costs that are caused by air pollution for asthma, lung disease, and heart disease. But some good news, the solar industry in the United States added 51,000 jobs over the last year, according to a solar industry group. That means there are now twice as many Americans working in the solar industry than are working in the coal industry. Solar now accounts for one of every 50 new jobs in the United States.
Don't tell Donald Trump.
And China is moving even faster. In 2016, China doubled its total solar capacity in just 1 year. And finally, Sweden has passed legislation binding all future administrations to reach net zero emissions nationwide by 2045. That's a law to ramp down fossil fuels and ramp up renewables to zero emissions by 2045, and no future administration can overturn it.
Finally, some good news. A shame we have to go all the way to Sweden to get any. For much more on all of those reports and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
So when you need—
Thank you, Des. I got to get out. I'm running late. Once again, a 3-judge federal appeals court panel has refused to reinstate Donald Trump's executive order barring entry to the U.S. of nationals from 7 predominantly Muslim nations. I got to go. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. More on that tomorrow. And to my guest today, Michael Slater of ProjectVote.org. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. Find me on Facebooks and Twitter at TheBradBlog. That's it. Happy birthday, Dad. I love you. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.